You're tuned to 90.7 KRWD Las Cruces. I'm Leora Zeitlin. It's my great honor and delight to welcome back into our studios David Amram. Most people describe you as an American composer. I would say a composer of the world. He has been called by Wynton Marsalis a godsend to those who believe in the power of music to change lives and inspire, and by Pete Seeger, one of the most talented musicians in the universe. Your influences, I've been listening to interviews with you, David Amram, from Bach, heavy study of Bach, to all the jazz greats, Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, many more, all the folk greats, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, many more. And you play numerous instruments and have played with folk and indigenous groups all over the world. And I understand you also have a New Mexico connection. So we can't talk about everything, but welcome back to Las Cruces. It's great to have you here. And then I must also say David Amram is here because the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra this weekend is going to be giving the New Mexico premiere of a double concerto violin and cello and orchestra called Partners. So welcome back.
Thank you. It's so nice to be back here. Always.
We also have a little bit of a family connection. So in full disclosure, I must have known you as a very little child at Marlboro Music, and I went over to my mother's condo today. She's since passed, to look at some of the albums, because in the last few years, I found a picture in one of the family albums of you at Marlboro as a very young man. If I find it, I'll post it with the with the interview. So welcome. I would. There's lots of things I want to ask you about, but tell us a little bit about Partners, because you draw on many of the influences of your broad musical vocabulary in it.
Well, I met Julian Pegas, who's the cello soloist, who's a member of the Dallas Symphony, at a concert, and I heard this terrific cellist. They were doing my saxophone concerto, Ode to Lord Buckley. And then he played a cello piece. I said, boy, this guy's great. And he said that he and his friend who also plays in the Dallas Symphony, Maria Schleinong, have a trio. And they mentioned some of the double concertos that they liked. And I said, well, boy, I love those pieces too. And he said, would you ever think of writing a double concerto? And I said, well, I remember hearing the Brahms double concerto so many times, and I loved it. And the Miklos Rosa. And I would love to do that, but I never thought or had a request to thought about doing that. And he said, well, we have a group. Let's see if we can get you a commission. And amazingly enough, they somehow were able to do that. And I thought I would try to call the piece Partners to show that a double concerto doesn't mean two people who hate each other, but rather partnership. Which is what all music built to last of every genre is about. And in Spanish, they call it en conjunto, to be together. In Native American music, the drum is the heartbeat of all people to bring us together. In European chamber music, same thing. In jazz, always the same. Then I thought, well, I would try to write each movement dedicated to a set of partners to reflect the beauty of all these different disciplines that celebrate partnership. So with all that hot air, I chose Okemah, Oklahoma's great poet, singer, Woody Guthrie, whom I knew, and your people in your audience can't see it, but I'm wearing Woody's sister's, who just passed away at 94, Mary Jo, on my right next to my heart. And I knew Woody in 1956, and he left Okemah and his travels, went to Harvard, got Pete Seeger, a Mayflower descendant, to drop out of Harvard and drop into our life. So the first movement celebrates Woody and Pete's partnership and the beautiful musics that they cherished. And that includes, of course, all the Appalachian music and folk music and country and Cajun music and Native American music. I made up my own Oklahoma stomp dance from what I learned from being in that part of the country. The second movement was Billie Holiday and Lester Young, the great singer and saxophonist who played so beautifully together. And the third was Machito, the great Cuban band leader who came here in the 30s, and Celia Cruz, the fantastic singer, and the wonderful work that they did together. And each of the three movements reflects their heritage and their partnership, and they use that as a point of departure to try to write a regular classical piece with every note clearly written, so that a classical violinist and cellist and symphony could play a piece that was generically based on all the musics that we have here in this country that make it so, so beautiful.
That, you were one of the early people, Gunther Schuller, also the third stream idea, the fusion idea of bringing lots of musics together into the classical hall.
Yeah, well, Gunther was my French horn teacher, and he heard me playing in a bar in 1954 when I was still in the Seventh Army Symphony on an off night playing jazz, and because he was a horn player, he walked in, he said, "I'm on Miles Davis' record, Birth of the Cool," he said, "but I don't improvise." He said, "You can improvise. You should come back to the USA, since I know you told me you want to be a composer, and study composition with Vittorio Giannini, and you can study French horn with me." He was still first horn in the Metropolitan Opera. And so I had the GI Bill, and I came back and went to Manhattan School. He was a wonderful teacher. You see, I never called the third stream, and I never called it fusion, because when you play chopsticks on the piano and you have two fingers moving in different directions, it's already fusion. And then when I was told I was a crossover artist, I said, there's nothing to cross over to. When you're in the land of beauty and you go across a bridge, you're still in the land of beauty. You're just in a different part of that land. There's nothing to cross over to because you're already there. And as everyone in your audience knows, when you're in the land of enchantment, you don't need any subdivisions to tell you that or any signs. You're there. And when you go to different parts, including where my Uncle Milton was born and brought up in Las Vegas, New Mexico, not Las Vegas, Nevada, and go there from Taos, where he went on a horse when he was a young boy, you're still in the land of enchantment. So to me, it wasn't fusion or crossover. It was taking all those beautiful musics, including what your dad played when Arnold Schoenberg's violin concerto. No one could ever really feel the enjoyment of that piece until your dad played it. He, I think, was one of the first ones that really brought out the beauty part, which was already there.
Yeah.
But he helped us he took us on that bridge in the land of beauty to show us what Schoenberg really was saying. But he understood what it was, and that plus he put himself into it too. And that's really kind of what music is about. It's there. It's celebrating the beauty, and all the different elements of that are apparent. And one of the nice things of being in New Mexico is it's already such a great place and such wonderful people and so many beautiful cultures that are here, that have been here, and are all respected.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, and that's my hope as a composer, to get people interested in the different beautiful musics, all of which are like a special language. It's not fusion or slopping it all together. It's like learning different languages, all of which reflect an individual, special way of being. And music does the same thing, and it brings us together.
Let's talk a little bit about your relationship with Cuba. You went there, I think, just about a little over a year ago, and you had gone in the 70s with a group of musicians.
Yeah, I got a call back after 41 years. I was there with Dizzy Gillespie and his band, Stan Getz and his band, and Earl Father Hines and his band, and Lionel Hampton canceled out at the last minute because he got a much better paying job. And they were stuck, so they said, well, Lam can speak Spanish, and can play with anybody. So I just, as I have all my life, because I'm here with you now again, lucked out. And it was incredible. And we weren't there as revolutionaries or communists or capitalists or anything. We were there as musicians, where we hoped we could transcend the differences and celebrate the relationship of Afro-Cuban music and jazz, and the appreciation people in Cuba had that love our country and our culture. They fantastic athletes, baseball players, and world champion boxers, and they also have phenomenal musicians. And we have world champion athletes and phenomenal musicians here. And there was a relationship between jazz and classical music. And, of course, I found in Cuba that many of the Latin and jazz artists also loved Beethoven, Bach, and Mozart. So if you did different things, you weren't considered to be bipolar or a jack of all trades or have a multiple personality disorder. You were simply trying to be an enlightened person and celebrate that beauty. And there are a lot of places in the USA that are that way now. And when I was there after 41 years and came back,
which was last year,
yeah, just last January, they had Randy Weston, Dee Dee Bridgewater, and Joe Lovano also representing the USA. And it made me really proud to be an American, because they were such wonderful spokespeople for our country and our culture and the beautiful things that we have to offer the world. And while none of us work as ambassadors or politicians, I was just honored to be part of that, to share with people there, as we do every place we go here and in Europe and in Asia and Canada, the different things that we have and the things that we celebrate from places around the world where people have come here to search for a better life, and also to try to give a little crash course in the civilized people who met us when we got off the boat, the Native American people who've been here thousands of years, and show that there's a gyroscope in America of gentility and culture and understanding and respect for others that we sorely need and which we're blessed to have and don't even often realize that we do have.
Mm-hmm. And you've played and worked with many Native American peoples also.
Oh, yeah, right here in New Mexico in Taos. I have my trumpet concerto, the second movement. It's called Taos, based on that beautiful moonlight song that I learned in Pueblo back in 1977. And my Uncle Milton he was brought up in Las Vegas, New Mexico at the turn of the century, and was brought up with Native American folks and loved and knew their music and knew a lot about that. And he introduced me to a lot of American Indian people that I still know, that he, kids and grandkids that he knew about. And I worked with Floyd Red Crow Westerman for 40 years and played all over Canada and the USA with him, and learned, and still am learning a lot about the place where I was born that we know nothing about because they don't teach that in schools yet.
Mm-hmm. Yet. And you were born in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, in Philadelphia. I was brought up on a farm in Feasterville, Pennsylvania. And my Uncle Milton would say, well, you know, look at when you're out in the woods of the farm here and you're looking at the sky and you hear birds and you see the way the sun reflects and you can feel things that were here before any of us were lucky enough to move from the old countries we came from to this blessed United States. Think about the people who were here and still are here, and look at the clouds and the sky and the animals and every other person that crosses your path, and think of things in that larger way than we're trained to think, mm-hmm, of what can they do for me, but rather how can you be part of something and contribute to something that's beautiful. So I was very fortunate to have that as a kid, and that helped to guide me through a lot of hard times and confusing times, and still does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leonard Bernstein invited you to be the first composer in residence with the New York Philharmonic, like in the mid-60s?
Yeah, 1966-67 season.
So you were a fairly young man. What was that for you in terms of your career?
Well, I always tell kids today, since I'm 88 and a mature teenager, even though I'm still a work in progress, don't think about building a career. Think about building a life. And Leonard Bernstein was very much that way. He was already at the top of his game when he was 22 or something. I forget the exact age. And Rosinski, the regular conductor of the Philharmonic, got sick. He was called at the last minute, with no rehearsal, conducted this incredibly complicated program and got a phenomenal front page story in the New York Times. Yeah. He was already a star way back in the beginning, but he never thought about that and never indicated the whole year was with him about that. He always talked about music and people and what we were supposed to do when we were here. So being the first composer in residence for the Philharmonic gave me a certain cachet, because they assumed I wasn't just a complete nutcase playing bebop on the French horn and writing music for Shakespeare in the Park and doing music for the Manchurian Candidate and Splendor in the Grass and writing symphonies and chamber music, rather than being considered to be a crazy, confused person. Because I got with the Philharmonic, some people suddenly thought, well, gee, maybe the guy's actually a composer and interested in music and interested in something besides himself. And Bernstein was a great role model for that, because with all of his celebrity and genius at everything that he did, he remained for real. When they say keeping it for real, that's what he was like every second. He was what they call in the vernacular in Yiddish a real mensch, a real down-to-earth person that loved what he did, loved his family, and wanted everybody in the world to appreciate all sincere music built to last. And when the manager of the Philharmonic said, you know, I saw the article in Life magazine, the result of your being here, and you mentioned old Guillaume de Machaut, who came before Bach, and all the pre-Bach composers, then Bach through Mozart, Haydn, then Brahms and Beethoven, of course, and all the Russian composers and English composers. And then you mentioned Kalsum, the great Arabic singer, and John McCormick, the great Irish tenor, and Big Spider Beck, and Louis Armstrong, and Thelonious Monk, and Charlie Parker, and all these people. How could you equate barroom entertainers with the masterpieces of European traditional standard repertoire music? I said, well, I was brought up with that appreciation of Bach and the standard repertoire, and I love it. And my composition reflects that allegiance to those masters. But I also love all the gorgeous music that we have in the United States, much of which comes from all around the world. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me like I was a nutcase. And I said, what they have in common is purity of intent and an exquisite choice of notes. And I could see in his eyes he was saying, Leonard Bernstein sure chose a turkey to be the first composer in residence with the New York Philharmonic. Thank God he's only here for a year. But I felt that way then, and I still feel that way now. And I'm amazed to see, as the world's changing, that there's more appreciation, especially among younger people, who can go on YouTube and see the masters of the European repertoire and masters of every conceivable kind of idiom of music, and they can wade through the tsunami of sleaze that's been dumped upon two or three generations and find those needles in the haystack and become a needle in their own haystack, and then turn off the computer and go and hang out and find out that there's other people who are also interested in these things, and that you can use the computer as a tool to discover it and then turn off the computer and enroll in what I call the University of Hangoutology. And even though I have 7 honorary doctorates, I'm still a lifetime scholarship student at 88 of the University of Hangoutology, because I find just being with people, if you're open and sharing, you can learn from them stuff that you would never know. And that can be anybody, someone who's fixing your refrigerator or driving a truck or giving you dental work or being a brain surgeon or a lawyer, whatever they do, they can show you something. And yeah, you learn that by keeping an open mind and being with other people and learning how to say please and thank you in as many languages as possible and trying to be genteel and respectful.
I just have to back up to make a comment about Bach versus the barroom musicians.
Oh, right.
Bach hung out at a local coffee house.
Oh, sure.
And wrote music for the Collegium there, and he himself was a barroom musician.
So the other thing is that he wrote the Brandenburg Concertos, which were for the Margrave of Brandenburg, who was Mr. Big of Bach's era, and he had the Bach Club Date Orchestra, since they had no DJs, come to play some dinner music.
Yeah.
And Bach said, well, I'll write some of the music myself. So for a big picnic, he wrote some of the masterpieces called the Brandenburg Concertos, and I looked all over the internet to see if they could show what the menu was for those dinners, and no one remembers what they ate, but they sure remember the dinner music.
Yeah,
because Bach exceeded the nature of the gig and left us with those blessings.
David Amram, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We could go on for an hour, and I wish we could. We're going to go out with a little bit of music for people to get a sense of the kind of orchestral music that you write, although this is a different piece. But it is called This Land, Symphonic Variations on a Song by Woody Guthrie. I think I heard, and you've just brought it in, so I haven't heard the piece, but I did hear you talk about it online, that Nora Guthrie and you had...
And her son Arlo.
And Arlo had conceived of this. Just tell us about the final variation, and we'll play it.
Oh, great. Well, it's a whole 32-minute piece, and I'll leave it with the library. And this was the very end of the piece where it showed Woody Guthrie, when I had met him in 1956, in the different neighborhoods of New York City. And we'll hear one of the neighborhoods where he heard a West Indian band playing and some of the other ones. And then for time limitations, you'll probably have to stop it. But it showed Woody Guthrie, who was brought up in Okemah, Oklahoma, also loved European classical music as well as folk music. And I did want to say that your symphony here is so terrific. My old friend Nancy Joy's first horn, and she had told me about it. And the conductor is one of the best I've ever had the pleasure of working with, like a real musician's musician. And the orchestra plays so beautifully, and they're so musical. And I'm looking forward to hearing the Rosenkavalier Suite and the great other pieces that they're playing, and honored to be on that program. And I just wish my Uncle Milton from Las Vegas, New Mexico, was still alive so he could hear his little nephew getting some appreciation in his home state.
David Amram, his double concerto for violin and cello, Partners, will be receiving its New Mexico premiere tomorrow night at 7:30 and Sunday at 3 at the Atkinson Recital Hall with the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, Lonnie Klein conducting. Thank you so much, David Amram, for coming in.
I thank you, and it's a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you.